So I'm here now with Jana Moore Lone, who is the founder and director of the University of Washington's Center for Philosophy for Children. And I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to KPLU. Jana, what is the lifeboat activity?
So the lifeboat activity was actually created by a colleague of mine, David Shapiro, who is the education director of our center. And the activity is that there are a whole cast of characters, and they're defined by age, marital status, occupation. So you have a 35-year-old fisherman who has three kids and is divorced. You have a 60-year-old lawyer who has two children and is married.
And so the scenario is that all these people, all these characters are on a lifeboat, and you're taking this into classrooms and presenting this scenario to kids by and large, right?
Yes. You describe the scenario and you say, okay, so we're on a lifeboat. We all have our, now who we are, we have our characters, and there's too many of us. And so several of us or one of us have to basically jump ship. And how do we decide? And the rule is we have to all agree, including the person who's going to be sacrificed. And we start off by thinking, what are the standards? What are the things that would matter? And often we end up talking about how can you really weigh one life against another? And one of the interesting things recently was I did this at, I teach philosophy classes at Children's Hospital, at the School at Children's Hospital, and I did this with the older students there. And usually the characters are really advocating for themselves, right? And in this classroom, these students were mostly offering to sacrifice themselves. And they
These are patients.
These are patients at Children's Hospital. And they were talking about kind of their own moral obligation to the larger community of the lifeboat. It was the first time I'd ever seen students turn it in that way.
I know that one of the characters on this boat is an older homeless woman. How did that person fare in the lifeboat activity?
That was a really interesting one because the student who was that character said, I'm the one who should jump off the boat. And another character who was a world-famous rock star with no dependents and a drug problem said, no, it should be me because I really have done everything I want to do. And then the young girl, she was probably 14, who played the homeless woman said, no, you don't understand. This is the most important thing I'm going to ever get to do, and you need to let me do it. And I think what was really useful in that exercise was it led us to talk about how all life has value and how it's virtually impossible to try and measure one life against another.
Well, Jana Moore Lone of the Center for Philosophy for Children is going to be back a little bit later on in the show. It's Sound Effect from KPLU, and our theme today is Somebody Saved My Life. So we'll be hearing that from a philosophical point of view, as well as plenty of other tales from around the region. So don't go away. To live in the Northwest is, to some extent, to roll the dice. If you lived through the 1965 Seattle earthquake or the Nisqually in 2001, or if you just read The New Yorker this week, you know this well. There are forces underground that could just shrug our cities off into the abyss. The push and pull of continental plates is so huge compared with a puny little human. And yet, for a guy named Kelsey Allen, the act of a child sheltered him from the seismic forces. And he spent decades being grateful to this boy who died saving his life. KPLU's Ashley Gross has the story.
11:55 a.m., April 13th, 1949. Below Puget Sound, the Juan de Fuca Plate plows deep beneath the North American Plate.
The Pacific Northwest reels under the worst earthquake in its history.
Mud geysers spurt into the air. Several homes slide into the sound. Railroad tracks buckle.
Buildings are shattered. Seven are dead, scores hurt, in the wake of the two-minute tremor which shook a 500-mile area, extending all the way from Victoria, British Columbia, to Salem, Oregon.
And at Lowell Elementary School in Tacoma, it's around lunchtime, and a few kids are in the ground-level basement as the floor starts shaking. One of them is a kindergartner named Kelsey Allen. An older boy, a crossing guard, notices him.
This little crossing guard said, hey, you're not supposed to be here. This is the girls' basement. We've got to get out of here.
That boy, Marvin Klegman, grabs Kelsey's hand and leads him out the door toward the schoolyard. Just after they come out, a brick cornice near the roof collapses.
He said, look out. You know, he tugged me under him, and the bricks came down, and the next thing I knew, I woke up in an ambulance.
His head got hit, but he didn't even go to the hospital. Marvin bore the brunt. He shielded Kelsey from most of the falling bricks with his body and was killed instantly. Myrna Phelps was a second grader also in the basement during the quake. Right after the shaking stopped, she saw a teacher weeping and carrying the limp body of 11-year-old Marvin Klegman.
I saw Mrs. Burquist, who is the second grade, I think, teacher, anyway, and she was carrying him. And she got so far down and somebody else took him from her because she was just, you know, hysterical.
Marvin was one of eight who died in the quake and the only one in Tacoma. He was mourned in the Jewish community that he was a part of, but no one had any idea that he had saved Kelsey's life. Kelsey and his family moved to Portland shortly after the quake. He didn't know the name of the boy who died protecting him. Slowly, the public memory of Marvin faded. His parents, Thelma and Sam Klegman, kept their sorrow and their love for him deep in their hearts and to themselves.
My parents were, you know, of the generation where they don't talk about things.
Keith Klegman never knew his older brother. He was born 4 years after Marvin died.
They never wanted to talk about the incident of Marvin's earthquake. They just didn't even acknowledge it, basically.
Keith grew up thinking he came from a family of four, his mom, dad, older brother Carrie, and himself. He says the first time he found out he had an older brother named Marvin who had died was when he saw a plaque at the elementary school.
I really think that's how I found out about it. I can't really remember my parents sitting me down and telling me about it. Isn't that strange?
But when he asked his parents, they didn't want to talk about Marvin, so his brother remained a mystery to Keith. Kelsey Allen, the boy who owes his life to Marvin, was grateful, but there was always something holding him back from finding out who Marvin was. He kept remembering what Marvin told him.
This little crossing guard said, hey, you're not supposed to be here. This is the girl's basement. This is the girl's basement. This is the girl's basement.
For years, Kelsey thought he had done something wrong. And maybe if he hadn't been in the girl's basement that day, Marvin would still be alive. He carried that guilt with him for years. But finally, something happened to make him decide he had to pay tribute to the boy who saved him.
A 6.8 tremor shakes western Washington to its core.
When the Nisqually quake struck, Kelsey's own daughter was in elementary school in Kirkland. He says the quake brought back a flood of memories and made him confront his feelings of guilt.
I thought to myself, if this isn't telling you to go find out that boy's name, for crying out loud. I went down, my daughter was fine, everyone was fine. And then the next day I was down in Tacoma here trying to find out the boy's name.
At the Tacoma Public Library, he looked up old newspaper articles and found what he was seeking. Marvin Klegman, 11, was the boy who had been killed on the school grounds of Lowell.
When you went to the library and you discovered the name, how did you feel?
I was really humbled, but upset with myself because it got to the point where I couldn't tell Marvin's mother. Because she passed away. And I couldn't speak with Marvin's dad because he had Alzheimer's. And if I had done that 10 years earlier, they would have known what their son did. It bothered me that no one knew.
But now people do know. The Tacoma News Tribune did a story, and a family friend of the Klegmans, Tacoma philanthropist Babe Lehrer, read it.
Man, did she take the mantle. She just went, and she raised funds.
Lehrer raised money for a statue outside Lowell Elementary. The sculpture created by Larry Anderson shows the two boys running, Marvin leading Kelsey by the hand. Kelsey says he didn't want to be portrayed in the statue.
I wanted it to be all about Marvin and what he did, and I was talked into it by Babe, talked into it by Larry. No, we need to put this. And now my daughter said, you know, what would this be without, if you weren't here telling people this? He's not here anymore. He can't say anything.
And that resonates with Kelsey Allen. He's packed a lot into his life. He's worked as a police officer and a cabinet maker. He learned to skydive, scuba dive, and fly airplanes. But sometimes he faces that nagging question.
Would we be better off with him or with me? You know, what would he have been? Maybe he was a doctor. Maybe he would have helped people.
How do you get over that feeling of, oh, he might have been a doctor. He might have helped all these people?
Just by honoring him.
Kelsey created a website in Marvin's honor called thelittlesthero.com. He talks to school kids about Marvin's sacrifice. Lowell Elementary observes Marvin Klegman Day on April 13th, and kids are encouraged to do something nice for someone else. Coming forward with the story gave Kelsey some relief. He spoke with a woman who taught at the school, and she told him he hadn't broken the rules by being in the girls' basement. It was just a line down the middle that he had crossed.
That freed me from a lot of guilt. That was a load off my shoulders.
Kelsey says most of all, he just tries to be grateful, day in and day out.
That inspiration is like normal. I mean, I'm singing on the way here. I'm going, why am I singing? Why shouldn't I sing? I'm happy.
Would you sing a little to me?
I just sing, oh, Lord, I praise your name. I thank you, Father. Thank you for the blessing. Thank you for this day.
Whenever he feels down, Kelsey Allen says he tells himself, there's no room for that.
Somebody lost, gave up absolutely everything so you could have everything. And why would I want to taint it by not being thankful?
That story from KPLU's Ashley Gross. Don't go away. We'll hear how a young woman's life was saved by the author of Superfudge, plus saving people who are supposed to save us. That's coming up on Sound Effect from KPLU and KPLU.org. It's Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme, Someone Saved My Life. When you're a kid, especially an adolescent, everything feels like life or death. But for Anastasia Selby, growing up in the Seattle suburbs, it was more than just preteen melodrama. When she was two, her mother left behind California and her father and the Church of Scientology and brought Anastasia to the Northwest. But here, they had a turbulent home life, and later on, there was abuse and hard drugs. And Anastasia would find her escape in books, and specifically in the books of children's author Judy Blume. We're talking Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and Then Again, Maybe I Won't, and Superfudge. And it's those books that Anastasia credits with saving her life.
I think it was probably second or third grade when I first encountered her books, and they really resonated with me. Specifically, there's a book called Tiger Eyes.
What do you remember in that book, Tiger Eyes, that connected with you?
The protagonist, Davy, she loses her dad and has to move, so it's just this traumatic thing. And throughout the course of the book, she discovers all these things about herself and is able to become independent and work through her problems. And that was so helpful to me because I very much wanted to have a father and didn't. And because I moved so much, I really had a hard time making and keeping friends my age. So I think that was the biggest thing about her books, that I felt so alone in my life and like nobody really saw me. And reading her books, I felt like I knew the characters and they were my friends.
So far, your story could be a lot of people's stories. Mm-hmm. A challenging childhood, you know, a kind of disorganized household, parents who aren't perfect,
and solace in these novels. Then things start to kind of veer off from the path that I think a lot of adolescents take. What happened when you were sort of 11, 12, 13?
I hated school. I would not go to school. I was in sixth grade, and that was the struggle my mom and I had, was her trying to get me to go to school and me not, and her having to work full time and not being able to deal with stuff. And she was also becoming physically abusive. So we had Child Protective Services come to our house. And when I was maybe 12 and a half, I just ran away and left my house and went to downtown Seattle and went to a homeless shelter. Actually, that's a point where I ran into my dad, and he came and picked me up and took me back home. I begged him to let me live with him, and he was living in a motel at the time. So, of course, that wasn't possible. And my mom was actually on a business trip. After I had run away, she had left on a business trip because she had to work. So that's why she couldn't really be contacted.
I'm sorry. Her 12-year-old girl had run away, and then she left town?
Yeah. Yep. It's hard for me to not make excuses for that for her, because I know that she had her own issues. And then when I turned 13, my mom got married to my stepdad, and it became an incredibly abusive environment. At that point, I just continued running away.
Were you still reading Judy Blume novels when you were getting into your teenage years like that?
No. I mean, I did drugs, hard drugs, at a very young age, when I was 14, when the first time I did methamphetamines, and got very into hallucinogens, and, you know, I did heroin for the first time when I was 16. And so my reading was not there, but I think that I'm alive today because of some of the books I read, Judy Blume included.
How did her books and the part of you that took its identity from them figure into your decision to just take off finally when you were in high school?
First of all, her books made me believe that the world was inherently good. And they made me believe that young women could be independent and were smart enough to take care of themselves. And I felt in my life that I was in danger with my parents, and I needed to get myself out of that situation. And I felt that I had the resources to do that. In the middle of high school, we moved to Olympia, Washington, and I ended up just dropping out of school, and I hitchhiked to California.
What happened next?
Oh, my. Well, when I got down into Oregon, I immediately ran into these two young men who were around my same age. And they're like, oh, well, we actually live on this farm in Humboldt County. And I lived on the farm for 3 months.
Can you give us a little bit of a thumbnail of what the chapters that came after that were?
My mom had written me several letters begging me to come home, and she apologized for a bunch of stuff and just said it was going to be better. And she and my stepdad drive down and got me. And I tried to go to high school again, and I couldn't. But luckily for me, there was an alternative high school starting in Olympia. It's still there. It's called Avanti High School. And it was just an incredible place. And I still had my problems, and my parents were still the same people. But there were teachers there who really cared deeply about the students. I was just surrounded by adults who really, really encouraged me and cared about me, and that's the only reason I graduated high school.
How to ask this without sounding like a dad? All right. You say you kind of gained confidence that you could take care of yourself, and that those Judy Blume novels gave you the idea that a girl could handle herself in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Part of me is like, wow, that is amazing. What an accomplishment. And part of me is like, no. Can't take care of herself in the world like that. And I'm glad that you were lucky and that you made it back, but you could have been unlucky.
Yeah, I totally agree. I honestly think, though, when I look at the two paths, I was doing a lot of drugs when I was living in Olympia, and I was very self-destructive when I was living with my parents because they didn't treat me like a human, really. And I felt like they wanted to hurt me. And when I was traveling and at the farm, I wasn't doing hard drugs, and I was much healthier, as absurd as it sounds. So it's kind of like, you know, yes, I would never encourage anyone as a teenager to go hitchhiking. That's stupid. At the same time, it was the only decision I had, kind of.
Did you ever come back to Judy Blume as an adult?
Yeah. When I was 29, I was actually working as a firefighter for the Park Service in Alaska. And my mom, it's a very long story, but my mom took her own life. And I finished out the fire season in Alaska, and I moved down to Seattle where my mom was living, had been living, and had to take care of so much stuff. And I had severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I was dealing with my mom's death, but I was also so much trauma from my childhood came up. I was actually disassociating from my body. And I bought like 5 or 6 of Judy Blume's books, specifically Dini and Tiger Eyes and the ones about people just feeling alienated. And I reread them and was incredibly surprised at how relevant they were for my life and how much they comforted me and reminded me of my childhood and made me feel close to parts of myself that were kind of closed off to me emotionally at the time.
Has anything changed about the way that you think about your mother or your father?
I have incredibly conflicted feelings about my mother. I've spent my lifetime making up excuses about her behavior. Some of them are very valid excuses. And I've also been through therapy and come to terms with who she was to me, which was not good at all in a lot of ways. So I think it's 5 years since she's died, and I think that sometimes I find myself sentimentalizing our relationship, and I run into people who are just like, remember the good things, and I'm like, but I also want to be honest with myself about who she was and allow myself to be angry about that sometimes. And as far as my dad goes, he died 1.5 years ago of leukemia, and our relationship was basically non-existent. He was a very angry person. And that's something that it just is. That's it. I think what I've learned from their deaths is that you can think in circles about things and try to figure things out, but there are just some things that are indecipherable and they don't have a, you can't tie them up and finish them off. They're just open, and that's just how it is.
Anastasia Selby ran away from home as a teenager, and she was inspired in part by young adult author Judy Blume. And she says the move probably saved her life. Now she lives in Syracuse, New York, where she's working on a graduate degree in creative writing. Anastasia, thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today we're telling stories of lives saved and the people who saved those lives. And here joining me now is Jana Moore-Lone once again, who is the founder and director of the UW's Center for Philosophy for Children. And Jana, you go into classrooms, right, and talk about philosophy with, I mean, how young of kids are we talking about again?
As young as kindergarten and all the way through high school.
You often use a book as a jumping off place. And there's a book that you brought in right now called 4 Feet, 2 Sandals. It's not that obvious how this story sort of gets into philosophical themes. So maybe you could explain what the story is and how it feeds into a philosophical discussion about saving lives.
So the story is about two girls who meet in a refugee camp in Pakistan. They have both come with their families from Afghanistan, and they form a friendship around a pair of sandals. So both of the girls have been without shoes for some time. They're both, I think, 10 years old, and they, at the same time, each find one of a pair of sandals. They, at first, each just keep the sandal, and then they decide they're going to share them. So one wears them one day, one wears them another day. And the story is about the way in which these sandals, which are now kind of one of their few possessions, create both a bond for them, but also illuminate how fragile their existence in this refugee camp is. And eventually, one of the girls gets notice that she and her family are going to be permitted to leave and come to the United States, and we are left not knowing what will happen to the other girl and to their friendship.
So what kind of conversation does this open up in a
classroom? It raises a number of different issues. So I've had conversations around this book about the nature of friendship, what makes the girls friends, why at the end does the girl who is staying behind in the refugee camp insist that the girl who is leaving take the sandals when it will leave her with no shoes? Is it the case that sometimes when we don't have anything, we want to be able to give something? We've had conversations about being a refugee and how decisions are made about which families get to leave the refugee camp and come to other countries. What are the standards through which we decide why one family gets to come to safety in the United States and another family does not? There's one scene in the book where the boys go to school because there's only one space, and so only the boys get to go to school. And I've had conversations with kids about why is it that the boys get to go to school and the girls do not? So it raises a wide range of questions.
Well, those questions about how you decide who can leave the camp and get refugee status, get protected status, and come to the United States. That seems to have a lot of parallels to that lifeboat activity that we were talking about earlier, where you're having to figure out who in a lifeboat you're going to save if you can only save a certain number of people.
It's actually very similar because you're, in some ways, you're measuring lives based on some objective set of criteria. And as students often point out when we have these discussions, you really then miss the fact that all these lives have value, right? All these people are suffering. I had this conversation with a group of fourth graders where the question that rose was, what are the standards by which we determine who gets to leave and who has to stay in the refugee camp? And some of the students were saying, well, I think it should be who's going to contribute most to this country, who has the most job skills, who's in the best health, and those kinds of things. And other students really disagreed with that and said, no, actually, I think it should be who can we help the most? It should be the people who have the least skills and have the hardest health issues and have had the most difficult time and struggled the most, because they're the people who need help the most.
Did you help them understand the implications of the points of view that they were adopting?
Sure. So, for example, I mean, if a student says something like, well, I think it's only people who have health problems who should be able to come into the United States, I might say something like, okay, well, so if that's the case, are we worried at all about the potential impact on health issues in this country? Or if someone says, I think that everyone should be permitted to come into this country and we should find everyone a job, and then I might say, well, okay, so are there obligations that we have to people who are already here that are different than the obligations we might have to someone who is coming to this country from a different country?
Well, that's where I would assume that a lot of the kids would go, right? We should just let everybody in. Why can't we let everybody in? We've got plenty of space, etc. And do you find that they can kind of understand why a lot of people would say that's not a realistic policy?
Actually, it's interesting because it's not where they go. I mean, you'd kind of think it would be, but
yeah,
it isn't.
Kids aren't as nice as I give them credit
for. They really see the difficulties. I mean, and a lot of these children come from families who have emigrated to this country, who have struggled, and they see that it's not a simple picture. So I think they want to be able to say, we want to do as much as possible. But like I had one child say, basically, look, we have so many people in this country who can't find jobs and who are going hungry. How can we help people who are coming from Pakistan before we help people who are already here? And then another student said, well, the fact that we're not doing enough to help the people who are already here doesn't mean that we have less of an obligation to help the people who should be here but haven't been able to get here.
Well, let's say I'm a kid who really can't settle on a way to evaluate one person's life over another. How would you get me out of that rut?
Well, I don't know that that's such a bad rut to be in, actually, because I think it's a very challenging thing to think that we can make good judgments about whether one life is more valuable than another. So a child who is going to be saying, I just think we can't make these kinds of decisions because every life is infinitely valuable. So I think it's really important to have someone in the room making that point, right? So I wouldn't try and move them away from that at all. I mean, and maybe that child is the one who ends up saying, I'll jump. because I can't judge that other people's lives are going to be less valuable or more valuable than my own. But I know, I mean, as one student said in this conversation, I know how I would feel if I didn't do this. I would always think about the people who died and known that I could have saved them.
Well, we'll leave it with that. Jenna Morlone founded and directs the University of Washington's Center for Philosophy for Children. The book we were talking about just now is called 4 Feet, Two Sandals by Karen Lynn Williams and Kadra Muhammad. And you can read more about it at kplusoundeffect.org. Hey, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is the kind of letter that Pamela Weibel gets.
Dear Pamela, an anatomy professor did in fact inform us that we would commit suicide at a higher than average rate and informed us from the lectern how to accomplish it successfully. Considered following the instructions on 3 occasions, most recently when a 4-year-old I had in the hospital died.
Okay, so this is a letter from a fellow doctor, a doctor who's grappling with thoughts of suicide. Physicians are in the business of saving lives, but they have one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. An estimated 400 doctors a year take their own lives. Pamela Weibel is a physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she's devoted a big part of her career to helping doctors cope with thoughts of suicide. As you can probably tell, this is a tough subject that's not going to be appropriate for all listeners. And this interview in particular gets pretty heavy. It's about 10 minutes long. When I talked with Weibel, she told me about the moment she realized how big a problem physician suicide is.
I was sitting at the memorial service for the 3rd physician that we lost in our small town in just over a year. And I sat there in the 2nd row of his memorial service, and I just started counting the suspicious deaths of doctors, and I realized I had quite a number of them, including both men that I dated in medical school.
What is it about the profession that makes suicide a particular risk?
Well, we have kind of an antiquated medical education model that's based on the kind of, I would say, tough it up, suck it up, you know, don't cry, feelings aren't welcome here, do your job, do it efficiently, almost like kind of a militaristic model of medical training. And that's very dehumanizing to the students. And a lot of medical students actually graduate with PTSD. So it's a traumatic educational process. And I think that's the root cause of much of this.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's really about the paradigm that's kind of drummed into them in med school and in training?
Right, because when you compare the mental health of medical students at the beginning of training, they come in with their mental health on par with or greater than their peers. And something happens during medical training that disables them, essentially.
Can you think of an example from your own training that demonstrates that, a way in which you feel like it dehumanized?
Well, besides the obvious sleep deprivation and the massive amount of material that we're supposed to learn, in my particular program, we had to do dog labs, which meant that every 4 students were assigned to one dog that used to be a pet, and we were supposed to kill it to learn very simple physiologic techniques that could be learned in other ways. And this is absolutely a dehumanizing process that I protested and was able to get exempted from. And in fact, they didn't even refer to this as an experiment. The physiology professor referred to this as an experience in which there was no alternative. And they actually made fun of me. The dean told me I had Bambi syndrome.
Do doctors get care when they need it? I mean, mental health care. I mean, considering that doctors are dispensing care and counseling patients all the time, you'd think they would know exactly what they need and how to get it.
No, absolutely not. In fact, we're not allowed to seek mental health care for fear of losing our license. On our licensing applications, there is a question that is actually in the same area as the questions about criminality and DUIs and felonies. In there, in that section, there's a question about if you've ever sought mental health care. And if you check yes, you will have to probably meet with the board in person to describe why you did that. And I've known a physician in town, actually, in Oregon, Lincoln, who was delayed in getting her license by 6 months because she checked that box being completely honest. And why she checked it is she sought counseling during a divorce. You know, everyone is depressed during a divorce. She had to pull her records, which that counselor had since retired. They made her go get evaluated by another counselor for her mental health before they would allow her an Oregon medical license.
So that has a chilling effect, huh? I mean, how do people...
It has a chilling effect because, you know, honestly, I have a friend who's a psychiatrist. She's an excellent psychiatrist, and she actually drives 200 miles out of town, uses a fake name, and pays cash to get mental health care.
Oh, wow.
How would you like that? In order to be off the grid and not be tracked by the medical boards. The other thing is I hear from medical students and physicians all the time that they actually are jealous of their dying patients in hospice, and they could wish they would you know, jump in bed and be the one with cancer so they could get some downtime and some rest.
That is so shocking. And it's so different than the lay public perception of doctors, that doctors are either heroic, mission-driven, you know, saintly people, or, you know, that doctors are business people or whatever. I mean, what you're describing is really alien to folks who aren't close to the profession, I think.
Physicians are not allowed to really be vulnerable and to share what's really going on. So they put on the white starched coat and smile and have their bow tie, and nobody really knows, you know, what's going on under that coat.
So you have chosen to tackle this in some very particular ways, including these retreats that you bring healthcare professionals on. Can you talk about those? Like what happens on them?
These whole things began as just business strategy retreats to try to help physicians who want to open independent practices. But interestingly, on that day that I went to this gentleman's memorial, that evening I had a retreat and I showed up, and I had fallen into this physician suicide topic in such a bizarre way. I just thought I would check in with the people attending the retreat. And I opened the retreat by asking, how many of you have lost a colleague to suicide? And everyone's hand was raised. And then I asked, well, how many of you have considered suicide? And every single hand remained up, including mine, except for the one female nurse practitioner.
Did that change the nature of those retreats then?
Well, I started to realize that a lot of people came to the retreats for emotional healing, and that really was in the way of them starting their independent practices. The emotional healing is required before we can really be the doctors that we dreamed of being.
So when you're together in those settings, how do you set about trying to help people?
Well, I think a lot of it is just having these healers off the grid. There's no cell phone, no internet service. I've got 40 to 50 doctors in a lodge room on 150 acres in the mountains of Oregon, and they literally are just finally willing to tell the truth about their experience in medicine. And so there's a lot of crying, there's a lot of hugging, there's a lot of validation. And I think people for the first time feel that they're not defective. The system is defective and they've been abused. The other thing that's so beautiful is actually, because we were wounded collectively, I do feel like the treatment for physicians is collective, meaning pulling off the weak ones, quote unquote, on the periphery and throwing them into a psychiatrist's office isn't the best way to deal with our collective wounds. So I think when you can get healers together, they naturally heal one another. It's a really beautiful thing to witness.
So you said that when you asked that question about how many people in the room had considered suicide and everyone's hand went up, including yours, what do you want to say about your own struggles with suicidal thoughts?
I want to say that I came into medicine, like most people, as an idealistic humanitarian that just wanted to help people. And the reason why I developed these suicidal thoughts, I mean, I did get into some major depression during my first year of medical school, completely related to those dog labs and watching the dehumanization process of my classmates, which was just brutal. But then once I got into medicine, you know, you're always thinking it's going to be better on the other side. Wait till you graduate. But I was pretty much like everyone else in the country, funneled into these assembly line medical jobs, which are not the definition of healing. 7-minute office visits where you're just feeling like you smack Band-Aids on people is not at all healthcare. And so I got depressed and suicidal because I felt like I cannot believe I invested 24 years of education, all this time and energy into a profession that I love. And when you're stuck in a system that does not allow you to be a healer, it's an absolute assault on your soul. And so that's where I was, the dark night of the soul.
What helped you emerge from that?
I had an epiphany that if the patients are miserable and I'm miserable, I'm looking at my colleagues and they look miserable, even though they're, you know, faking it sometimes and putting on these smiles, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to turn this over to my community. I'm going to lead a town hall meeting, and I'm going to ask the end user, the patient, to design their ideal practice, to write my job description, and I'm going to work for them. And I've been so happy doing this now for 10 years. And what I call an ideal medical clinic designed by the patient.
Do you see any signs that this is getting any better? Is the training?
Yes, definitely, because we're talking about it. And I think the fear of speaking about the trauma that we experience as medical students and physicians is dissipating, so that we're more able to have this open and with the internet, you know, kind of conversation. And the fact that we're no longer hiding all these bodies and hiding all the data is the big first step. I mean, if you think about it, you know, to use a medical analogy, there's no way you're going to solve somebody's medical problem until you have the correct diagnosis. Where would we be if we were afraid to say Ebola out loud or HIV? We would be nowhere. And so we've got to be able to say physician suicide out loud. And the next question after people recognize that this is a crisis is why? And when people start asking why, then we start solving it.
Well, Dr. Pamela Weibel is a family physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she joined us from there, from the studios of KLCC. She works with doctors in the Northwest and all over the place on suicide prevention. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Yeah, thank you.
This episode of Sound Effect was produced by Kevin Kniestad with senior producer Arwen Nix. We had help this week from producer Matthew Strive and intern Bree Ripley. Web help from Mike Lewis. Ashley Gross contributed to the show this week. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Have you not subscribed to our podcast yet? What is the matter with you? I'm just kidding, but we are on iTunes. It's free, and you can also leave us a review while you're there. And you can send feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. You can also tweet at KPLU or at Gabriel Spitzer. Another episode comes your way next week when we talk teamwork.
I was on my knee waiting for Brooms Up, and I was thinking, okay, I've been practicing a couple months, throwing a quaffle round. This is my first match of intercollegiate Quidditch, and this is the craziest thing.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.